I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Bill B. from Lakeside.
Whoa. Hi, everybody. My name's Billy. I'm an alcoholic. Love to see all my alky friends with me tonight. God damn, you're a good group. Look at you, all smiling and happy and shaking hands and loving each other. That's what this whole thing's about. I got sober November the 4th, 1968. And I haven't had a drink since. I celebrated 50 years last month. Wow. Thank you. And when I got here, I was broken, mentally, physically, and spiritually. I couldn't rub two nickels together. There was no more collect calls to dear old dad for 10 bucks, and it was all over with. There was nobody wanted me around, and my family rejected me because I was such a bad drunk. And I did things to people that were mean and hateful and dishonest. I was a liar, cheat, and a thief. I took advantage of people. I took advantage of the innocent. I lied, cheated, and stole. And when I worked for people, I used to do that. And after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know I was an alcoholic till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And how that happened, I was living in a one-room lockup in Ramarillo, Texas. And I woke up in a hedgerow, 4:30 in the morning. You know how we do that. I was broke and hungover, freezing my ass off. And I got back up to this one-room walk-up I had, which was up on the third floor. And I went, oh, Jesus. I walked over to the window, and I looked out, and I thought, you know, I could take it, because I was miserable inside, totally miserable. And I thought to myself, you know, I could take a swan dive out of this window and it'd be all over with. I wouldn't have to worry about nothing anymore. And then I stepped back and I looked down again. I went, if this don't work, it's going to hurt like a son of a bitch. So being the chicken that I am, I backed away from the window and turned on one of those old early black and white TVs. And Billy Graham came on. And he was hanging up that, holding that book up and shaking it. And I watched him for a minute and I thought, he's always good for a laugh. Let me watch him for a minute, you know. Now, I don't know what he said, but this is what I heard. He said, if you feel unwanted, unloved, and you're not sure you're going where you're going in life, why don't you get on your knees and ask God to help you? I thought, I'm just drunk enough to try that, you know. So I got on my knees and I started whimpering and crying and feeling sorry for myself and asked God to help me. And after that prayer, I got in bed. And between that and three weeks later, I came to my first AA meeting. And what happened, I lived in California at one time. And I'd been married and had a son and they lived in California. I thought, I got to get back to my son and my wife. So I thought, well, I got about $100 in my pocket. So I thought, well, I'll fly out. I found out it was too much money, and I didn't fly, and I thought, oh, I'll take the bus. And it was $70, and I couldn't afford that. I have to have some walking around money when I get there. So I went out on old Route 66 and stuck my thumb out, you know. It was about 5:30 in the afternoon. It was starting to get dark, and I thought, oh, man, I don't want to be out here in the dark, you know. And it always amazes me how one drunk can recognize another going 65 miles an hour. You know? They pull over in this little Opel Cadet, and there was two gals in the front seat and a little 14-year-old kid in the back. And they said, could you help us out with gas? And I said, hell yeah. So I got in that car, and they started squabbling and calling each other bitches and assholes. And I went, oh, geez, I got to get out of this car, man, when we get to Albuquerque. Well, midnight was Albuquerque. It was colder than summer. I'm not getting out of that car. So I looked at this kid, and he was a glue sniffer. And he had this bag, and I went, God damn, what's wrong with him? You know? And anyway, I tell that story because I think one day they'll show up at one of these meetings, you know. But anyway, they never have. Anyway, I got to California, and this buddy of mine had a clothing store out in Malibu, and he let me sleep on his couch. And I was there about 2 weeks, and his wife says to him, "You got to get that buddy, your buddy here, out of here. He's getting trucked too much. You guys are drinking too much." So I thought, oh, Jesus. So I looked at the paper, and it says, "Room for rent, house on the beach in Malibu." So I went down, knocked on the door, and this guy came to the door, and I said, "Man, here they look at the room." And so went in and looked at the room. I had my own room, my own bedroom, my own bathroom, and a shower, and a telephone, and a TV, and a big window that looked out at the ocean. And I thought, oh, man, I've reached utopia. So I said, "I'll take it." I said, "How much is it?" He said, "It's $150 a month." I'd never paid $150 for anything in my life at that time. But I did have $150 in my pocket. So I handed it to him because I knew I was supposed to be there. And I didn't know why. So as I'm handing him the money, he says, "By the way, do you drink?" I said, "Oh, I have one or two on the weekends." He said, "Well, I don't allow drunken parties here." I said, "I don't give drunken parties. I go to the bar to drink." He said, "Good." So that went on for a couple of weeks. I said, "Anything I can ever do for you, you just let me know." 2 weeks later, he came in. He was the secretary of a Saturday night speaker meeting. He says, I need help setting up the chairs. And I went, oh, shit. And so my first meeting was to help you poor bastards out, you understand. Set up the chairs. I made the coffee, put out the cookies, and I sat in the back of the room, way in the back in the corner. And people started coming in the door, and they were well-dressed. Women were getting out of, you know, nice cars, and they were smiling. They had all their teeth in their mouth, you know. And these guys come walking in. A guy got out of a brand new Continental. I thought, how in the hell did he get there? And they came in. They were hugging each other. They were shaking hands. It was just fabulous. And the gals were kissing the guys on the cheeks. I thought, what the hell is this, a church social? And then I thought, well, I'll just see. And the next thing I know, they're coming up to me and they're sticking their hand out. They made me feel welcome. And what I come to find out is that's our spiritual love for one drunk to another. We stick our hands out. We welcome people. We tell them what our story is. And we help them to stay sober. And they help us stay sober because they're listening. So I sat in the back, and after the meeting, I walked out. And they said, "Anybody else here?" And I didn't raise my hand because I didn't know I was a drunk. But I kept coming back to the meetings. I went to Venice, I went to West L.A., I went to Santa Monica, I went to downtown L.A., I just loved coming to meetings because I could hear things that emotionally and mentally and spiritually I could identify with. And I'd been looking for something like that for a long time. I've been to all the different churches. I've been Baptist twice. I've been to the Catholic Church, got sprinkled on. I wore a beanie one time at the corner. And then I went to the Buddhist temple, thought I could hum my way to heaven, you know, and that didn't work. So when I got to AA and people started to love me back to life, and I kept coming to meetings, even though I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. And finally, after a couple of weeks, I raised my hand, said, "I'm an alcoholic," and everybody just clustered around me and hugged me. And made me feel welcome, made me feel warm, made me feel loved. See, when we hug each other and kiss each other on the cheek, that's not a physical hug. That's a spiritual hug from one drunk to another. Don't take it the wrong way, okay? It's a spiritual love that we give each other. And so when I learned how to do that, I started going to meetings, meetings, meetings. I went to a meeting every day. For 2 years, I didn't meet as many. Sometimes I went to morning, noon, and night meetings because I loved it. I couldn't wait till the next meeting. I couldn't wait for that spiritual love to grab me inside and hold me together and make me feel wonderful. I felt wonderful from the first day I ever heard you guys talk. And I still feel wonderful. I still go to 5 or 6 meetings a week. You know why? Because I don't want to miss the answer for knowing how to live the next day. And my sponsor said to me, I got no sponsor after I was about 3.5 months sober. And his name was Johnny Bradley. Johnny came off of Skid Row. And he looked at me and he said, do you really want to stay sober? I said, yeah. He said, if you don't drink and go to meetings, this is what I want you to do. So he gave me a little project. He says, I want you to read the big book. I didn't have a big book. He got me a big book. He says, I want you to read Bill Wilson's story because it'll tell you about the spiritual part of his life where he got God in his life. It's in the last 4 pages of his story. And he says, I want you to read Dr. Bob's story because it'll tell you about how the fellowship started to happen. And I want you to read the doctor's opinion because it'll tell you why you think the way you think. And I listened to what was said. I couldn't believe it. And it was just fabulous. I read and I talked and I read and I talked. And I would come to him and I'd say something about, well, what about this and what about that? He says, what part of the big book don't you understand? That used to really piss me off because, and I'd say, well, I don't know. He said, well, you read the big book. And he'd tell me what to read, and I'd start reading it. Reading the big book helps, believe me. Because I hear people come to meetings, and they get called on to talk. And they say, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And I think, what part of the big book don't you understand? Read the big book. When I first got sober, there were no recovery centers to go to. You got sober going to meetings, being with other drunks, loving each other back to life, reading the big book, go to meetings, 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 and listen to what's said. Take what you need for reference. And the reason I do that is because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love hearing all the different stories. I've never gotten a DUI. I got pulled over by the police in Amarillo one time. They took me down and put me in an ante room. They came in 2 hours later and handed me my key back, and they said, do you think you're sober enough to drive home? I said, hell yes. I drove home. But that was the only time that ever happened to me. I've never been in jail, never got a DUI. But the thing about it is when I got here, I was so broken inside, I didn't know which end was up. So my sponsor said, this is what I want you to do. Read what I told you to read. And every time the basket comes around, I want you to put a dollar in it. And he said, I don't care if it's your last dollar. You put a dollar in that basket. And you know what? I've done it every year, every day since I've been sober. I always put money in a basket, no matter what it's for. And the reason for that, he says, if you put money in the basket, you'll never go without a place to live and 3 meals a day. And I believed him. And I haven't had ever gone without food. I've always had enough for rent. I've always done that because things will happen if you listen to your higher power. And people in this room will tell you how you can do that. It's simple. I get my higher power by looking out at a group like you and seeing the smiles on your faces and how much love you have in your face for me. And that's the spiritual experience. I'm having a spiritual experience right now with all of you. This very moment, and especially this guy right here. One of my dearest loving friends sat right there. Give him a hug when you get up. He's an old timer. Let me tell you something. I don't know where you've been or where you come from, but the emotions are the same. We don't care if you've been in jail or you came from Yale. The feelings are the same with all of us. We're human beings with human feelings, and you're entitled to your feelings because you're a human being. Good, bad, or indifferent. Be pissed off. Be happy. Be joyous. What are you doing today to bring joy into somebody's family or to your friend that's sitting next to you tonight? Did you shake anybody's hand when you came in here? Did you give somebody a hug when you saw them? I go right up to people I don't even know and shake their hand and say, how you doing, baby? Oh, yeah. You know, they wake right up. It's just fabulous. This room full of people that love each other back to life is absolutely fabulous. Anyway, I got sober, and I was sober about 6 months, and I couldn't seem to find a job. Well, actually, 3.5, 4 months. And I couldn't seem to find a job, and I was just so disappointed in myself. I had no feelings of, you know, that I had something I could offer. I was just broken. And so I'd make out a, you know, one of those things, a piece of paper for employment, and I'd get about halfway through it. And I'd look at it, and I thought, shit, I'd just rattle up and throw it away because I knew they weren't going to hire me anyway. So I went to him one day, and I said, I can't seem to find a job. He said, what are you doing? I told him. He said, do you really, really want to go to work? And I said, yeah. He said, I said, but, you know, I'm thinking about going down and maybe getting on welfare or food stamps or unemployment or something. He says, if you do that, don't ever talk to me again. You've had a free ride long enough. Now, do you want to go to work? I said, yeah. He says, you go down on Wilshire Boulevard, you walk all the way to the ocean, and you go into every business all the way down. And you walk in there, and you tell them that you need a job. You don't care what you have to do, but you need to go to work. I thought, well, shit, I'm an executive. I can't do that shit, you know. So he said, if you don't do it, don't ever talk to me again. That scared me. I went down to Wilshire, started walking down the street, went all the way to the ocean, which was 26 blocks. I crossed the street, came up the other side, walked into a Big Five sporting goods store, and the guy said, make out this application. He hired me right there on the spot. I went to work at 9 o'clock the next morning in a Big Five sporting goods store, one of my greatest things that ever happened to me. And I've been working ever since. Because of what he told me to do. And I've, you know, worked many, many jobs. When I took my inventory, before I got sober, I put down how many jobs. I had 144 different jobs before I got sober. I've only had 9 since I've been sober. And 10, 15 years ago, I retired from my own business. Now, that's amazing. Anything that you need, you want to happen to you, work the program. Talk to people that you respect. If you have a problem in business or a car or something in your life that you can't figure out, go to somebody who knows what they're talking about and say, what do I do about this, this, and this? And they will give you some answer. It may not be the right answer, but it will be an answer. And if you go to people enough, you're going to get the right answer. And you're going to know what to do because it'll come to you up here and in here, and it will immediately happen for you, you know. And in sobriety, I've been down to my last dollar putting it in the basket. And when I threw it in, I remember what Johnny Bradley told me. I've never forgotten that. And I still do that today. And in the first few years, there's been some times that I've been really broke, too. So anyway, I started working, and one thing led to another, and then the next thing you know, I've got a little apartment, and it's unfurnished, and I thought, I need to go get furniture. So I go to Johnny. I was afraid to go buy it by myself. I had money for it. So I went in, and he said, well, let's go down to this furniture store, Broadway store downtown. So we go down the basement where they have all the sales on furniture. Guess what I got? I got a mattress. I got a bedroom set with a dresser and a mirror. I got a living room set with a couch, a coffee table, a brand new TV set, and another chair. And I said, oh, they're going to deliver it for me. So the next day I'm waiting for it to deliver there at 2 o'clock. Well, they didn't come at 2 o'clock. I thought, oh, shit, they're not going to bring it. Next thing you know, they're knocking on the door. We got your stuff. And they came in and they set it all up for me, made the bed for me, did the whole thing and walked out. And I sat there and looked at that furniture. Did you ever smell new furniture? Nothing like that smell when you get brand new furniture in your place, you know. I'd go to a meeting at night after that. I'd open the door. I'd walk inside and I'd go, I'm smelling that furniture. And then I'd walk over and sit on the couch and I'd hug it. like me, and cry while I'm hugging it because it was so wonderful to have new furniture. And I had a job at ABC TV Studios. I was a mailroom boy. Then I had another job. Then I had another job. Then I went to work for a company in Beverly Hills. It was an a company where I was sober about 2.5 or 3 years, and I understood this guy wanted an assistant to help him in his office and drive him around. He was an agent, and he had big stars. And I had a little Chevy Mazdas, you know, that are kind of square looking and had a little rust on the side, like all drunks have when they're first sober. And that's what my car was. And he owned this big 9-story building. He had agents, he had lawyers, he had secretaries, he had everything. And he owned a bistro in Beverly Hills on Rodeo Drive. So I'd been there about, maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and I drove in one morning, and he usually didn't get to work till about 9:30, and I'm there at 7. And I would drive, and I'd park way back in the back with that little car. So anyway, he came in at 7 o'clock one morning when I'm coming in, and he sees me drive back in this old beat-up Mazda, and I waved at him, and he waved at me. And about an hour later, I had a little office off of his. He came in about an hour later, I was there. He walked in the office. He says, "Bill, come with me." I said, "Oh, are we going to the studio or something?" He said, "No, just come with me." And we got on the elevator and went all the way down. So we got out of the elevator and walked over to this car that was a Bentley convertible. And he handed me the keys. He said, "This is your car. Get that fucking other car out of here." My company car was a Bentley convertible. Can you believe that? And I went to work for him, and he owned, the bistro, and we'd go to lunch, and there was an A room upstairs and a B room downstairs. So we'd go to lunch. I'd eat in the B room. He'd go eat in the A room because Steve McQueen was there, and Barbara Streisand, he discovered, and numerous other big stars at that time. And I had a wonderful time, wonderful time. And that led to something else. So one day I got out, he came in, he says, "I can't use you." And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Nothing's the matter." He says, "I just can't use you." I said, "Okay." And he gave me a recommendation to go anywhere. So I went in and had to give him the keys back to my Bentley convertible. That hurt. And I went to work in the mailroom at ABC TV. And I was there for about 2.5 years, and then I went and got another job somewhere else, and another job. Then I started trying to be an actor, and it never worked out. I became an extra, worked in the business of Linux. Then I learned how to do stunts by a guy by the name of Paul Stater. Paul Stater was Johnny Weissmuller's double in the old Tarzan series back in the 30s and 40s. And Paul was his double. Every time you see him swinging through the trees, that's Paul Stater. That's not Johnny Weissmuller. So he taught me how to do stunts, back falls, high falls, martial arts, whatever it is, fiascos. There's a whole different glossary of that kind. So I learned how to be a stuntman. Then I started working in the movie business. And then it took me 9 years to get my Screen Actors Guild card, okay, because they don't hand those out for nothing, Took me 9 years to get that, and then I really started making the money. And then I went to different places on location, and went to different movies. You'd never see me in them because I'm always in the background doing something else, or I'm standing in for somebody. You'll never see me. There's only one movie you can see me in, even today, and it's called The Stuntman with Peter O'Toole. We filmed it right over here at the Coronado Hotel. And we had people jumping out of windows. That was me. We had people sliding down the roof. That was me. And all this stuff. And one scene where the guy's coming through the skylight, falling down into this bed with this gal, and we pick him up and started taking him out, and I'm right there in front of the camera. You'll see my face right there. That's the only one you'll see me in, okay? But anyway, it's still wonderful, and I still, every once in a while, even last year, the last time I worked was 12 years ago. I was up in Montana, and Dennis Quaid was making a movie. So I went and auditioned for it, so I became the sheriff in his movie, the only movie he ever wrote and directed. He's never done it since. So I still get a residual check every now and then from this movie I made 12, 15 years ago. I had a great time. I've had a great time. I've gone from one situation to the next. And after I was sober for about 5 years, I went over. I was down in San Pedro. I ended up being a yacht salesman in Newport and Marina Del Rey. And I was loving it. I always loved being in the boat business or being around boats. When I was a kid, my dad had a boat. So I've always loved boats. So anyway, what happened was that I had this thing about I wanted to learn how to do that. So I was when I'd gone over to Europe and came back, and I was working as a security guard at the L.A. boat show. So I looked and looked, and it was four days on the weekend. So I said to my sponsor, I said, I think I'd like to be a boat salesman, because I could see these guys walking in with a deck shoes and a nice tie on and a sport coat and pants and this and that. And he said, do you really want to do that? And I said, yeah. He said, then you go into that night and you look at every boat there is. You get all the brochures you can. You find out what works, what doesn't work, generators, motors, diesels, hydraulic system, different makes of boats and various things like that. And when I learned how to do all that, or understood I thought I learned how to do it, I found the guy that hired me to be a boat salesman. And I sold the boat within 3 months. And it was more money I'd ever seen in one clump at one time was my commission. And the second year, I sold the largest cruising boat on the West Coast to the granddaughter of the Dodge cars in Detroit, who was living in Santa Monica, and she bought a boat. It was $800,000 for that yacht. I got a commission check for $15,000. I went, my God, I've never seen that much money in my life, you know. And I went, oh, man. And then I went to Europe, and then I came back, and then I did this, and I did that, and one thing led to another. I kept working and working and working and doing things. I bought a condo down here when I moved from L.A. I came down here in 76. I bought a condo out in Ocean Beach for $44,000 because I had a down payment for it. And a buddy of mine who was in the banking business, I didn't have credit worth a damn. And he said, which bank are you talking to? And he told me. So he went to the guy who was going to give the loan to me, and he said, give him the loan. He will pay for that. The guy said, okay, because he was going to turn me down. So I got my little condo, and I had it for 5 years. Then I sold it 5 years later, and I made $85,000 off of it. Then I'd gone up to a place called Red Lodge, Montana, with a friend of mine. I went up there, and the guy said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll find something. So I bought this old rundown motel. It was really beat up, and I had to fix it up and put money into it. And I put $58,000 into it because the wiring and the plumbing and the roof and everything had to be fixed, and the windows had to be fixed. And so I put all this money in them. Well, it's a ski resort area in the wintertime. So I thought, this will be great. And here I am sitting there. I went up there in May of 84, and by June, I ran out of money. I thought, Jesus, nobody's coming into this motel. What am I going to do? And a seismograph crew showed up in town and rented every room I had, including the garage that I was living in. And the next thing I know, this money's coming in, you know. And then that first winter, we had very little snow. And it had I'd advertised in ski magazines and different. We didn't have any snow hardly, and nobody, and people were canceling, and I was running out of money. I was living on different things. Well, what happened a few years before that, I went down to San Pedro when I was a broker, and I ran into this guy. There was a navigation class that we were teaching from the Coast Guard. And so I saw this guy in the chow hall. He had gray hair, and he was a first-class cook. And I said, "Man, aren't you about ready to retire?" He said, "Are you kidding? I just got back in." I said, "How'd you do that?" He said, "Well, I put 11 years in, and I got out, and they let me come back in." I said, "How did that happen?" He said, "Well, you can come back. You can come back in up to the age of 35. Well, hell, by that time, I was 40. I thought, there's no way. So I went down and talked to this lieutenant commander who was a reservist at the harbor. And he said, "You go down and talk to the recruiter." He said, "With the time you had before, that goes back to where you can be 35 years old. And they will let you back in." And I got back in. And when I'm driving down there, I looked up and I said, "God, if I get back in, I'll stay till I get a check." And I stayed in the reserves until I retired. And, you know, it was, and they sent me everywhere. I was a combat CB. You know what CBs are? The guys that build, airports and butler buildings and work on. And I was they taught me how to be a heavy equipment operator. And the next thing I know, I'm out there running big tractors. I'm going to Port Leone, Africa. I'm going down to Vegas Island. I'm going down to Puerto Rico. I'm going out to Hawaii. I'm going to Saipan. I'm going up. It was fabulous, just fabulous. And I did 2 to 4 weeks every year on active duty. I'd come back, and then we drill one weekend out of the month, and that's how you build up your points so that you can retire. And I get a check every month from the Navy now. I get all my medical bills paid for by the Navy now. If I get sick, I go down to Balboa Island and they work on me. Doesn't cost me a dime. That's how lucky my higher power has taken care of me, you know. This program will work in every area of your life. Every area of your life. If you just stay sober, go to meetings, listen to what's said, have fun with this thing. You will meet people in this meeting that you will dearly love. And if you got a resentment, hang on to it, baby. Because it's going to kill your ass. I remember when I first got sober, there was a guy up in L.A. I couldn't stand to talk to him. If he came to a meeting and he walked in, I'd get up and walk out of the meeting. I didn't want to even be in the same room with that son of a bitch, you know. And about 4 or 5 years went by, and I went up to him one day, you know, I've got to make an amends. So I went up and told him I was sorry for what I thought about him and what I said to him and what didn't he. We shook hands, and we became the closest friends that we'd have ever had. And he's still my friend today. He still goes to meeting, and he lives in L.A. And we talk to each other every year. Isn't that something? Isn't that something? So if you got your resentment, hang on to it, buddy, till it kills your ass. And when you get ready to get rid of it, see, it doesn't make any difference for you're right and they're wrong, or they're right and you're wrong. When you make an amend to somebody, you're cleaning up the outside of your soul so that you can be happy, joyous, and free, and walk into a meeting and shake somebody's hand, give them a hug, kiss the ladies on the cheek, and enjoy life. There's nothing like a life of AA. There's nothing like working and being a part of the big book, you know? Work the steps. They will give you a life you never thought possible, ever. Go to meetings on a regular basis. I still go 5 or 6 times a week. You know why? Because I don't want to miss the answer for knowing how to live the next day. This thing don't work too good sometimes, you know. So if you're in this meeting today and you're sober, you're a miracle in action. And whether you're right or you're wrong doesn't make any difference. And if you came from jail or you came from you, the feelings are the same. God looks out after all of us in one form or another. He protects you. He takes care of you. He don't care what you say to him. He's not paying attention to you anyway. All you have to do is show up and tell him you love him and thank him every day. I don't know about you, But I've woken up in cold hedgerows, freezing my ass off. And today, I have a home that I own. I have a warm bed that I sleep in, and a roof over my head, and a hot cup of coffee that I'm about to have that I paid for. And there's nothing better than that. And then I say the Lord's Prayer, and I thank God for all the gifts and the miracles that He's given me over these last 50 years, and they continue to happen on a regular basis. A regular basis. Now, my lady is right here in the front row, and I love her dearly. You know why? Because she's a beautiful woman with a beautiful inside, and she loves me, too. You know what I'm talking about.
Watch it now. You're walking home.
Oh! She's telling me I'm walking home now. Anyway, thank you for being here for me. Thank you for taking the time to listen. And I hope you got something out of what I said that you can take with you and carry it to somebody else to keep them sober too. God bless you and thank you for listening.